You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, November is the peak month for deer collisions on Wisconsin's roads. We'll look at how crashes break down geographically around the state and why repairs are getting more expensive. Now, Republican Assembly Speaker Robin Voss held a press conference yesterday to talk about COVID-19-related legislation that his caucus could support. Shortly before that, Governor Tony Evers proposed a $541 million package aimed at offsetting the economic fallout from the pandemic. It's the first significant talk of legislation in Wisconsin since April, after leadership in the state Senate weighed in. Getting any of those ideas passed is looking like a tall order. Plus, today, extended mask mandate? Sean Johnson, WPR's Capital Bureau Chief, joins us now. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
Let's start with yesterday. We have these dueling announcements from Speaker Voss and Governor Evers. Compare and contrast for us, please.
Yeah, I mean, they kind of fed into the other. So we had this announcement around noon that the speaker was going to hold a press conference that afternoon to talk about COVID-19, legislative priorities. And then moments later, the governor introduced a COVID-19 bill that he said his office said they'd shared with the speaker's office the night before. So what we have after all that is one bill, and that is a bill draft from the governor, which does a lot of things. You know, noteworthy steps that it would take are letting the state ban evictions, putting a variety of restrictions on insurance companies when it comes to health plans, covering testing and treatment related to COVID-19, and also a lot of money for things that are being paid for by the federal government right now, like testing, some tax cuts. There would be a lot of state money set aside in this bill if the federal government did not renew that funding on its own.
And what do we hear from Speaker Voss about possible legislation, not drafted, I understand, that they might consider?
It's kind of unclear. I mean, the speaker was very clear that they did not have a bill in the state assembly. Republicans did not. And he wanted to talk to the governor. The speaker said that he was supportive of increased testing and increased contact tracing. Those are kind of the two big picture ideas that he said he was in support of, but he didn't like some of the other big picture items in the governor's bill. You know, he didn't like the ban on evictions, and he didn't like how much the governor's bill would spend in state funding for, these things that the federal government's taking care of right now.
Rocky steps there. And then we heard from the new president of the state Senate, Republican Chris Kapinga. What did he have to say about all of this?
Well, Kapinga told the Journal Sentinel that really there's not much that he has seen up to this point that he would support, you know, that he doesn't think that the state necessarily needs to be stepping in and doing more when it comes to contact tracing, for example. So you got to remember that the Senate, which was already very Republican, just got more Republican in the last election. And there are new leaders. Kapinga is now the Senate president. There's a new Senate majority leader. And so there's just a new mix of people in the Senate making decisions. And it is more conservative than it used to be, before November. So that's kind of where the Senate president is at. You know, he can't speak for everybody exactly, but he's speaking for himself there, and he's been elected to a position of power in that body. And he's saying that he doesn't want to see the state necessarily more involved here.
So we've got big numbers in the state. We're going to talk to a public health expert about that in just a few moments, Sean. It sounds like this all adds up to not very likely that anything is going to get passed by the legislature and signed by the governor. Is that a fair read on this at this point anyway?
Well, I mean, it's been 8 months since they agreed on the last thing. You know, the legislature has not passed a bill related to COVID-19 since April. And the governor hasn't signed something that they have passed since April. So obviously they see this issue differently. You know, they have spent a lot of time fighting each other in court, where the governor has issued emergency orders of varying degrees, and they have been fought by Republicans on the grounds that he exceeded his authority by not going through them. So I don't think it's a slam dunk that they are going to agree on anything. You know, that I think that would be probably a foolish bet to make given that what we've seen. But you did see at least the governor out there and the assembly speaker out there saying that we are willing to talk.
And speaking of emergency declarations, a new announcement from Governor Evers saying he wants to extend a mask mandate further. It was supposed to expire, I think, this weekend. Where is that right now? Does it exist right now, given the court challenges?
You know, so the mask mandate, the one that we're under until this weekend, is still there. There were Supreme Court oral arguments earlier this week in a case that would strike that down and that would block the governor's power to issue similar mask mandates in the future. So as we stand right now, you know, the mask mandate has not been struck down and the governor's power to issue that mask mandate has not been struck down. So he can do what he said he's going to do today, unless the state Supreme Court steps in and says otherwise, you know, and says that no, the governor doesn't have the power to issue and reissue these public health emergencies without the legislature stepping in to explicitly grant him that power.
All right, that's what we'll watch next. Sean, thanks for bringing us up to date.
All right, thanks, Rob.
That's WPR's Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson talking to us about the latest from Governor Evers and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss when it comes to action on COVID-19. Meanwhile, the state reported a record 7,989 new coronavirus infections today, along with 52 deaths. Today, Governor Evers extended that statewide mask mandate into next year. We'll see what happens with that court challenge. Other states have taken similar steps. Michigan recently issued new gathering restrictions. Republican governors in North Dakota and Iowa are putting mask mandates into place. You can join in 800-642-1234. Do you think Wisconsin needs enforceable statewide rules to fight the pandemic? What are you seeing in your part of the state? Has COVID-19 affected you or your family? What do you want people to know? What questions do you have about COVID-19 and the efforts to turn the tide? Call 800-642-1234. Dr. Patrick Remington is back with us, Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Remington, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be back, Rob. Thanks.
Well, we've got this back and forth in state government here in Wisconsin about statewide mandates, a lot of states taking their own form of actions or inactions. What are you watching for when it comes to effective measures at the state level to try to turn these escalating numbers around?
Well, one of the challenges with COVID-19 is a lot of information and a lot of misinformation. And it's challenging, I think, for everybody when you hear so much bickering by elected officials about the legality and the appropriateness of a governor, an elected governor, to be able to make such a mandate. What I'd like to hear is where there's common ground. For example, it was mentioned that contact tracing and testing might be common ground, that in response to a pandemic, you need testing. We need to know who's infected and who's not. And then that information alone isn't sufficient. We need to have employed contact tracers to follow up. So if that's common ground, I'd rather see the legislature and the governor getting together and figuring out how to do more testing and better and more contact tracing than to continue to debate who has the authority to issue an order.
Well, here's a common ground and a common message. We saw Governor Evers join the governors of six other states, mostly Midwestern, including a couple Republicans, a bipartisan letter, an op-ed urging people to not travel for Thanksgiving, not have big get-togethers for Thanksgiving. Is that a good message right now?
Well, I think it is a good message. It's a very opportune time for everybody to think about what they're doing, what we're all doing to contribute to be part of the solution. And if you know, this is a time when governments can make orders, and there are public health statutes which enable local health officers and our state health officer to make such orders. But I think more than anything, it's a time for everybody to demonstrate their personal responsibility to not do things that will make this pandemic worse. And one of them is to stay at home on Thanksgiving. I've seen some very clever ideas. I teach a class at the university, and students are staying within their family unit, but connecting these family units through social media. That's a great idea to have the safety of not coming together during this time, but also still connect. Of course, you don't all get to share the same turkey and dressing, but you do still get together, and you're not increasing the risk of transmission because, as you can see, the numbers. I recommend that any listener just Google DHS for the Department of Health Services and COVID. Just look at the case number. That line has skyrocketed, and there's no end in sight. This is going up. By my guess, with 8,000, almost 8,000 cases today, in a month or 6 weeks, we could double the number of cases that we've seen in this state. So this is a pandemic out of control. Yes, we need government orders and you know, consistent messages, but we need everybody to be responsible and make the right and safe decisions.
Now, you talked about bad information out there. I want to listen to a clip of a nurse in South Dakota, Jody Doring. She had tweeted about her experience working with patients dying of COVID-19. Here's an interview with her on CNN talking about how people, even as they're literally dying of COVID-19, don't believe the disease exists. Here's a listen.
It wasn't one particular patient. It's just a culmination of so many people. And their last dying words are, this can't be happening. It's not real. And when they should be spending time FaceTiming their families, they're filled with anger and hatred. And it just made me really sad the other night. And I just can't believe that those are going to be their last thoughts and words.
Just the persistence of misinformation, Dr. Remington, even such a horrific circumstance of somebody dying in an emergency room.
Well, it's very hard to put risk information into sort of common terms. I think for most people, they hear stories about the person who had mild symptoms or maybe got sick but got better. But the numbers really don't lie. Yes, there are some people who are at the end of their life with a serious chronic illness, maybe in a nursing home, and they pass away as a result of COVID, but the years of life that they lost may not be so significant. But that is matched by the number of people who are younger, who have severe illness, and who die as a result of this disease. With 3,000 deaths, by the end of the year, most models predict Wisconsin will have over 5,000 people dying. And extend that to 1 year, this will be one of the leading causes of death. And nobody would dismiss the number of people who die from heart attacks or from cancer. This is going to be on that magnitude, on that scale, unless we stop transmission. And it's, you know, this is, we can treat illnesses pretty well, but not this one. We don't really have the effective treatments that we would like. The best medicine is preventive medicine.
Talking to Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the School of UW Medicine, UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at COVID-19 in Wisconsin. You can join in with your questions and thoughts and maybe experiences at 800-642-1234. What are you seeing in your part of the state? Are you worried about how we're handling the disease? Do you work in healthcare? What are you seeing where you are? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Verrett. We pick up our conversation with Dr. Patrick Remington, Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health, looking at the latest on COVID-19 here in Wisconsin as the nation knocks on the door of 250,000 deaths from COVID-19. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences, and what do you want to see from state or local governments when it comes to mandates about masks and gatherings and things like that? And how are you handling Thanksgiving this year? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Michaela joins us now in southwestern Wisconsin. Michaela, hi.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure. What did you want to tell us about?
I guess I wanted to share what I'm seeing. I work in the city of La Crosse, and I live in a small town south of La Crosse. In my workplace, I'm seeing from the get-go, we implemented masks. I work at the People's Food Co-op, and we as a collective implemented masks before there was any sort of official mandate. In the small community that I'm from, I still continue to see zero masks on either employees or customers of certain establishments. So I kind of have the question, what does mandate even mean? Who and what is enforcement of this looking like? You know, I've gone in full protection to a few establishments where I was the only person wearing it in the environment.
Thanks a lot for sharing your experience. Dr. Remington, she is not seeing a mask mandate, even when it exists, enforced or observed by people.
Well, she makes a couple of great points. First of all, the comment that we as a collective, and I think this is an opportunity for communities to act collectively, to all agree to do the responsible thing, which is to socially distance and to wear masks and to really be as careful as you can. If you can stay home, certainly do so. If you're part of the essential workforce, do that with care and good hand hygiene. And she also points out tremendous cultural differences between a mandate, which is a law that is virtually unenforceable. We don't think the state police are going to come and give people tickets for not wearing a mask, but it's a signal about the right thing to do for the collective, for your community. And so, again, I think we're not looking for mandates as enforceable laws. We're looking for mandates as information that people can use and then hopefully act collectively and think about your neighbor as much as yourself when responding. So I think it's a great example. Wisconsin is made up of many diverse communities. Some communities, I think, have embraced this order, not because of its a fear of enforcement, but because of the spirit of the collective.
Thanks for that call, Michaela. Let's go now to Alan in La Crosse. Alan, hi.
Yes, good afternoon. Thank you for taking my call. As I said, I am from La Crosse, and I have some concerns about a community Thanksgiving dinner that's coming up. It is an event that I volunteer for year after year, but I will not be volunteering for it this year. I have reached out to the powers that be for the event, and they've assured me that every precaution is being taken. They are not doing a dine-in service like they normally would. Instead, it will be delivery and pickup only. Is this something that can be done safely, or does your guest feel this is just irresponsible given our current situation? And I'll take your comment off the air. Thank you.
Alan, thanks for the call. So they're not all dining in together, so that's at least a good first step. Dr. Remington, what do you think?
Well, I think it is an important step. One of the biggest risks with COVID is that it spreads through the air. And we know that indoor spaces, particularly that aren't well ventilated, are high risk. So I think that's a first good step. I think if people practice good hand hygiene and wear masks and food preparation, there's very little evidence. I'm not aware of any reports of transmission in for example, in carryout by touching a paper bag or food that's been prepared. Again, obviously take the reasonable precautions where for food preparation. But I think this is actually a good example of a response that still allows people, particularly maybe people who can't get together with their family members, to have that meal, but do so in their own home, in the safety of their own home. So I think, you know, there's no right or wrong. There's you have to think about the risks and make the right decision for you, but clearly not gathering with people outside of your close family, not gathering in indoor spaces is the first step people should take.
Thanks for that call. We'll go to Tom now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I heard the doctor appealing for cooperation between the governor and the legislature for things like contact tracing, but I'm under the impression that the rates are so high now that contact tracing is not feasible.
Tom, thanks for the call. I've heard, Dr. Remington, that we don't have enough contact tracers given the scope of the disease. What do you think?
Well, we are in a surge situation, again, with almost 8,000 cases. You can imagine the challenges for some communities that might have a small staff of contact tracers. I think there's a question of sort of how we get through this surge, and that really is prevention. That is everybody staying home and complying with the order, even though not because of, again, as I've said, not because of fear of enforcement, because it's the right thing to do. And then with that, we should see a decline in cases, and then we can catch up. It's very difficult for local health departments to find these people, to employ them, to train them, especially if you were ready to go in August. With your local health department, with the staff, imagine, just look at the graphic on the Department of Health Services page, is now there's 10 times more cases. So how do you all of a sudden find 10 times the number of contact tracers? So that's extremely challenging. So it's even more important when we don't have enough contact tracers to do even more to prevent transmission. Someday, hopefully, we'll get to the point where there are a few cases, and those few cases can be traced. We can find contacts, have them quarantined, put people in isolation, even use technology. But we're not there now. We really need to stay at home, stay safe, so that this surge can turn around.
And briefly, Dr. Remington, just to recap, when we're interacting with people, masked better than unmasked. Better ventilation, better than bad ventilation, less crowded, better than more crowded, right? The same basics keep on applying, don't they?
The basics of this virus haven't changed. It spreads from person to person, more likely to spread the closer you are, more likely to spread indoor, and more likely to spread when people aren't wearing masks. So all the things you mentioned, stay outside. If you're going to gather, gather outside. There's some very clever technologies and techniques to do that. So, and certainly wear a mask whenever you go out.
Dr. Remington, thanks for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob.
Dr. Patrick Remington is Professor Emeritus in the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. He joined us for a look at the latest on COVID-19 in Wisconsin. Coming up, we'll crunch the numbers on car-deer collisions on Wisconsin roadways. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we talk with a pair of professional cyclists who have a connection to the Oneida Nation here in Wisconsin. Now, November is the peak month for deer collisions on Wisconsin roadways, but it's a danger all year long. In fact, there's been at least one deer crash every day for more than 1,400 days in Wisconsin. Our next guest took a look at the numbers around the state and talked to repair shops about what they're seeing this time of year. Joe Tashler is a business reporter and assistant editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Joe, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Well, you crunch the numbers, Joe, about deer crashes around the year, all the way down to hours of the day and things like that, that they're most common. What did you find in terms of the trends in deer crashes throughout the year here in the state?
Well, the one thing that we've found that has been somewhat remarkable is that there's a deer crash somewhere in the state of Wisconsin every day. And it's occurred for the past 4 years that we've been looking at these numbers. It's just they tend to peak in November, right about now. But throughout the year, there's at least one crash every day in the state, somewhere in the state.
And why? Talk about how it peaks in November and why it peaks in November.
Well, in November, the deer are in their mating period, known as the rut. So they are looking for a mate, and that causes them to run all over the place. They with really reckless abandon, I guess, is probably the best way to say it. They lose a lot of their caution, and they just go. And run, they're all over the place this time of the year. We also see a spike every year in June, a spike in deer crashes, and that's attributed to does, sending out their yearlings, kind of sending them out to out on their own so that they can prepare to have more fawns. So they're running around quite a bit in June too, but November, wow, lots and lots of deer crashes.
So this is a fine time of year to be careful, and right about now is a fine time of day. Did I see Friday actually at 5 o'clock, that dusk time is kind of the daily peak? Is that right?
That's what we were able to come up with. And I should credit the Journal Sentinel's Andrew Mollica too for crunching these numbers. He's one of our data-driven reporters who puts these numbers into a computer and crunches them every year for us. And what we were able to come up with is, you know, right around 5 o'clock on a Friday night in November, that's a very likely time that you might collide with a deer somewhere in Wisconsin.
And speaking of that somewhere in Wisconsin, you also tried to break it down by county. What did you find out when you did that?
You know, for 3 years now, the counties that have the most traffic and the most deer have the most crashes. That just seems to make sense. So it's Dane, Waukesha, and Washington have been, you know, 1, 2, and 3 for the past few years that we've looked at it. But then there's also counties where you don't have a lot of traffic. Shawano County, Sheboygan County, Manitowoc County. You traditionally don't think of them as having a lot of traffic, but yet they are in the top 10 in the number of deer crashes that occur every year.
Talking to Joe Tashler from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. He and his colleagues crunched the numbers on car deer collisions in Wisconsin. Spoiler alert, this is the time of year you really got to watch out for it, but there are collisions every day of the year going back 1,400 some days. Joe, you tackled this from another angle. Also, you talked to some repair shop owners in a couple of communities. What did you hear from them?
Well, one of the things we've been hearing from repair shops is that all the technology that is on newer vehicles, in other words, the lane deviation warnings and crash alert warnings and those types of safety devices, those are really expensive to repair when they're damaged. So what we found out in talking to repair shops is that instead of, say, 10 years ago, you might have to fix a bumper that came in contact with a deer. This time, if that bumper has collision warning sensors or lane deviation sensors, you not only have to fix the bumper, you have to fix the sensors, and then you have to sync everything up with the computers in the vehicle. So the repairs are getting quite a bit more complicated. And as a result, they're more expensive as well. And I talked to one body shop guy who said he had one in there that had adaptive headlights, which are the headlights that kind of turn as you go around a curve or as you steer. And one headlight on that vehicle cost $4,000. And wow. So both headlights were damaged. So just for two headlights, and they didn't even do any other estimating for the body of the vehicle. Two headlights, $8,000 right off the bat. So,
wow. So that repair could be expensive. You also heard from them that this time of year, with all these car deer collisions, you might also have to wait a while to get the work done in the first place.
Yeah, you know, I talked to a guy in Waupaca County who a body shop owner, and he said, yeah, they just get buried this time of the year in collisions, even more so than when the winter weather strikes. Typically, you know, the first snowfall or first time the roads get slick, you get a lot of crashes. He said, no, he said, up here, people are pretty good driving in the winter weather. It's the deer crashes that really put them behind, that they really have to, they're really, really busy. So, you know, might have to wait 4 to 5 weeks to get your car in to get it fixed in some places.
Now, COVID has changed a lot this year. Has it made any difference in what we're seeing when it comes to car deer collisions?
You know, we won't know that until the state, you know, they're keeping track of, they keep track of all the every crash in the state every year. So we won't know that for a while until they can get those numbers compiled. Anecdotally, we are hearing, you know, on our, we monitor the police radios and that sort of thing in our coverage of the region. And we're hearing, you know, 4, maybe 5 deer crashes a night in some counties, Washington County, for example. So at least anecdotally, it sure doesn't seem like the crashes have trailed off much.
But, as we wrap up, speaking of deer, I understand you are a hunter yourself. People, I think a lot of people may be planning to get out and hunt this year. Has this changed your plans? Does it make it look different to you at all?
Well, the coronavirus has absolutely changed our plans. For our deer camp this year, we're going to stagger things so that we don't have everybody in the small farmhouse at the same time. So we'll have folks hunting on the opening weekend of the gun deer hunt, and then folks during the week, and then folks toward the on the end of the weekend. And you know, those traditions will be interrupted this year. We'd rather not have to do that, but boy, we sure don't want anybody to get sick.
Joe, so, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Thank
Joe Tassler is a business reporter and assistant editor at the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel with us to talk about deer crashes on Wisconsin roads peaking this month and becoming more expensive to repair. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about deer hunting just ahead of the opening of gun season this weekend.
For many Wisconsinites, deer hunting is more than just a seasonal hobby. It's an opportunity to slow things down for a bit and take some time to enjoy the outdoors with friends and family. Ron Weber shares a story about how every fall, a humble dwelling in the Wisconsin Northwoods is transformed from a cabin to deer camp.
Most of the year, we simply call it the cabin. A small two-bedroom retreat with a modest kitchen, living room, and a bathroom, slightly smaller than the average ice fishing shanty. Nestled on Eagle Point along the crooked shores of Lake Namekagon in Bayfield County, it is a favorite destination any time of the year. But for 9 days each November, it becomes something much more. It becomes deer camp. Deer camp actually has its genesis about a month earlier. As the colorful tapestry of October leaves fall to the ground, it signals the beginning. Though there are numerous other activities to fill the autumn days, the seeds of deer camp have sprouted. Just an inkling at first, which can be satisfied by taking a look at a deer rifle or rummaging through hunting gear. The feeling continues to grow as the days shorten and the steely cold November landscape takes hold. Warm Indian summer days offer only a brief respite. By the second week of November, the urge has now become so great that it can be satisfied only by pulling out the blaze orange clothing that have been waiting patiently to reappear since last season. It is inspected and hung outside to air out. Drive anywhere in Wisconsin the week before deer season, and you will see orange dotting backyards like so many pumpkins. Knives, flashlights, ropes, compasses, and assorted other equipment are checked and rechecked. Deer rifles are sighted in, cleaned, and oiled. Just days away now, the anticipation is almost unbearable. I feel a primal pull towards the cabin. I like to get there Thursday or early Friday before opening day so I can watch the transformation. There alone, it is still the cabin, but as others drift in one or two at a time, it magically becomes deer camp. Food, clothing, guns, and other assorted gear quickly fill every corner. The camp is also now filled with jokes and laughter, stories of past hits and misses, and a most special brand of camaraderie. Each of us stakes out our piece of real estate to hang clothes and stow gear for the coming season. Deer camp is more than a place. It is a unique state of mind and being. For the next week and a half, life is reduced to its simplest terms. Planning the next day's hunt or checking the coming weather are the biggest concerns. If only for this short time, all other worries and responsibilities seem to fade, covered up by, hopefully, some fresh snow. If lucky enough to have a camp in a poor service area, even smartphones and other devices can be put at bay. A good deer hunter is an eternal optimist. Whatever did or didn't come down the trail today, there is always tomorrow and a new chance. The chances and the people who share them is what deer camp is all about. All too soon, though, there are no more tomorrows. As the season draws to a close, those who have stayed on all season begin packing up their gear. On the last day, vehicles are loaded, some last-minute pictures are taken, and reluctant goodbyes are said. Making a last check of the place, with a sense of melancholy, I realize deer camp is gone, and it is simply the cabin again. Until next November.
Ron Weber is an author and forester who lives in Weyerhaeuser. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast feed, wherever you get your podcasts. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Coming up, a pair of groundbreaking cyclists have a big Wisconsin connection. They're also brother and sister. We'll talk to them about their careers and their efforts to pass along a love of cycling. That's coming up next on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. A lot of major sporting events have found ways to continue this year, making necessary safety modifications during the coronavirus pandemic, among them the Tour de France, which was postponed a month and concluded in September. Professional cyclist Nielsen Paulus got the opportunity not only to compete in the race, but also represent a group that doesn't have a huge presence in the sport, Native Americans. Nielsen and his sister Shayna Paulus, who's also a professional cyclist, share a connection to the Oneida Nation here in Wisconsin, though they were raised in California. We have both of them with us now. Shayna, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
And Nielsen, thanks for being with us.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be here. Thanks for having us.
Nielsen, let's start with you. Can you tell us a little bit more about your experience with the Tour de France this year?
Yeah, it was a bit of a crazy year to race my first Tour de France. It was always a dream growing up, and it was a goal I'd been working towards for what seems like forever, just to at least compete. But this year was definitely pretty crazy. Just getting to Europe was pretty intense, just flying into the United Kingdom and quarantining there for 2 weeks, and then flying into Spain, where I do most of my training with my team before the tour. And then after I got into Spain, I had to do another quarantine with my team in a small country called Andorra. And we had to test ourselves about three times until we could leave that training camp and then go to the start of the tour, which was nuts. So it was incredibly difficult just to make it to the tour. And then being able to race it this year was just such an incredible experience.
And Shayna, what kind of racing have you been able to do this COVID year?
So I've pretty much just done one race this whole year, at least in real life, amongst other real people. But yeah, that was in February. I did the Valley of the Sun stage race with my team, Team 2020, professional women's cycling team. And since then, I haven't done an actual in real life event since then, due to COVID, unfortunately. But thankfully, I've been able to do a lot of virtual Zwift racing, which has been such a blast. And it's really challenged me in a lot of ways, both physically and mentally, just because we've been doing it pretty consistently ever since COVID hit. But yeah, I mean, it's been like a fun new opportunity to improve with my virtual racing. And yeah, it's been a blast, and I'm thankful that we have that, because other than that, we haven't really been able to have any opportunities with racing in real life.
And Shayna, I understand you and your organization are working to get more youth, especially in and around Indigenous communities, into sports and cycling. You're hoping, pandemic permitting, to do some summer camps, including here in Wisconsin. Tell us about that project.
Yeah, so our foundation was started last year with my boyfriend. His name's Ely Onku. He's a current defensive tackle for the Dallas Cowboys in the NFL. So we partnered with a few other people to kind of bring this Dreamcatcher Foundation to life last year, him and his agents, and then, of course, him and I, with the main goal of being able to provide youth sports camps for youth of all ages, 18 and under, and then more specifically Native youth. So last year we were able to host our first annual camp, which was a football focused camp in Ely's hometown of Ottawa, Ontario, Canada. And it was a huge turnout. We had almost 150 kids show up. So it was a huge success. And we were planning to host our second annual camp this summer. But unfortunately, with COVID, that was pretty much impossible. But we are looking forward to hosting our next camp, hopefully next summer, if we can. But again, it's hard to plan right now just with how COVID has kind of just been lately. But we are hoping next summer will be the time to host the next camp. But yeah, we are hoping to eventually host a camp at some point in Wisconsin, either in the Green Bay area or on the Oneida Reservation, just because I have quite a few family ties in Oneida. So we would love to host either a cycling camp or a football camp or a combined cycling and football camp. But yeah, we're just kind of playing it by ear right now and seeing where things go with COVID. Again, we don't have anything set in stone right now in terms of where our next camp or when it's actually going to be. But yeah, we're hoping hopefully next summer, and maybe Wisconsin, maybe in Canada again, but we'll just have to wait and see.
And Nielsen, can you talk about how important it is to you to be representing Native Americans in your cycling?
Yeah, it was really incredible the amount of people that were reaching out back from Wisconsin and just across the nation in general from many other tribes as well, but especially from the Oneida Tribe of Indians, just constantly having people contacting me, reaching out, saying how inspiring it was that that I was sort of being a trailblazer for North American Native Americans in the Tour de France. And it was a pretty unique feeling, I think, because the Tour de France is such a event that's it's so steeped in history, and at least like to the French people, like that race is like just right in line with like the history of their country as well. And they use it as a way to showcase their country. But then when you have someone who has history that goes even it comes from a nation that has history that goes even deeper than the French people, even the French were getting extremely excited and really intrigued by my background. And I think that being able to have the level of influence that I had available at the tour was just amazing. And I think that my ability to, I don't know, just reach a lot of people with that story sort of helped to resonate with the Native youth in America, and just other Native news outlets as well were really just taking hold of it. So it was a really incredible experience.
Just a few moments left, Shayna, your brother and sister, you're both performing at a high level in your sport of choice, cycling. What got you both into it?
Yeah, so that's a great question. We get asked quite a bit. So our parents were both athletes. And my mom was an Olympic marathon runner who competed in the 92 Barcelona Olympics, representing Guam. And my dad was an Ironman triathlete for many years. He's done like 14 or 15 Ironmans. So I mean, with both of our parents being athletes for years, they just kind of got us into athletics from such a young age, just because they had that similar background. So yeah, I mean, our parents had us in so many different sports from such a young age, whether it was anything from gymnastics to soccer, basketball, volleyball, track and field, cross country, swimming, everything, you name it. I can only think of a few sports that we haven't tried. But yeah, cycling was kind of something Nielsen and I got more and more into, I would say, during our high school years. That's when we kind of figured out that was the sport that we both wanted to end up in and kind of prioritize. But yeah, I definitely don't think Nielsen and I would be where we are today, especially in our professional careers, if it wasn't for our parents and their motivation, their encouragement, and their guidance for both of us through the years.
Shana and Nielsen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Shana and Nielsen Paulus are professional cyclists raised in California with ties to the Oneida Nation in Wisconsin. Coming up next, it's the news, and then it's our weekly look at the top stories in national politics with the ongoing latest steps in the transition in the White House. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.